Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Scottish Clans Podcast. I'm Clint Edwards, and I hope you're ready for another interesting episode where we get to talk about Scottish clans. I tell you what, I never get tired of the subject. I could be neck deep in this the rest of my life, I think, and never run out of things, never run out of questions. Man, I can't wait to get into our episode today, but first, let me read to you some of the feedback I've received since the last episode. The first one is, correspondence that's taken past just in the last few minutes. I have one from Micah Graves, and Micah says, "Hello, I'm listening to episode 5 and 6, where you talk about the history of the clans. My question is, what is the Ross clan's background? I didn't hear them listed, but I may have missed it. Thanks, Micah." And so my response to Micah is that I have officially added the Ross clan to my list of clans to research and do a podcast episode about. So just to let you all know, this is what I'm tracking on my list of clans to talk about on this podcast. I've got the Grants, I've got the McThomases, the Leslies, and if I've had more than one, I start to make a little hash mark by it. And so the Leslies, I've got 2 people that have requested that, kind of like I had with the Roses, which we've already done. The Rutledges, Clan Donaghy, the Grahams, and I've got a couple of people who have requested information on the Grahams. And then, the Roses, the McVerichs, the McPhersons, the Douglas, and the Ross clans. So, like I mentioned, we've already done the Roses and the Clan Donaghy, or the Robertsons of Struan, which one listener swears up and down that they're not the same thing. The line's pretty blurry, I think. Anyway, don't want to get too much into that. And as you may have noticed, because you consciously saw this episode, unless you accidentally touched the screen when you weren't meaning to, you probably deliberately saw that this episode is going to be about the Grahams. So here I am. There's more than one of you that have requested this clan, and I'm going to get to that. Anyway, that's my list of clans, with the newest addition being Clan Ross. So Micah, I hope you're pleased, and I can't wait to get to the Rosses, because the Rosses were, I think, fit into an interesting category of clans. The Rosses are that's a territorial name that comes from people who once were from the area called Ross, and at one time held the earldom of Ross, yet at a certain period of time, other kindreds obtained that earldom, and so the people with the actual surname of Ross do not hold the title, kind of like the Sutherlands and the Gordons, where the Gordons inherit through the female, through an heiress, the earldom of Sutherland, and so the people with the Sutherland last name, who were descended from Freskin de Moravia, or Freskin of Murray, that kindred does no longer hold that title, the earldom. So I just think that's a really interesting thing that I think I'm gonna, in the future, choose to just talk about that phenomenon and include other clans who fit that category. So glad you mentioned it, Micah. Another one I have here is from Clive Wilson. This just comes from last Monday. This is in response to the last episode where we talked about septs of different clans. And Clive says, "I definitely have a Scottish surname of Wilson, a sept of Clan Gunn, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong." Well, I'm not going to necessarily correct you. I hope nobody took away from the last episode that a sept was not necessarily part of the actual clan. I hope that's not what you took away. Just to recap that concept, just very briefly, I tried to communicate that a sept may be an actual branch of the clan. When we use the word branch, we're talking about, no kidding, their family tree connects into the family tree of the main family of that clan that holds the leadership of it. They are related. So, like, an example would be the Campbells of Glenorchy were actually descended from the Earls of Argyll, the chiefs of all the Campbells. That would be a branch. A sept, then branch can overlap, but also a sept may not be related at all. They may be a family or a surname or a kindred that lies within the territory, owes their allegiance to that particular clan, and our adherence to them. And so when the chief of a certain clan sends out the fiery cross and rallies his men to their clan gathering spot, they would answer that call, despite not being actually descended from that chiefly family. And then another option for a sept is that you are a branch of the clan, but you may have a different surname. So like the McDonalds of Glencoe began going by McKeon, or McKeown, as did the McKeons of Ardnamurchan. So they're all McDonalds, but somewhere there was a notable ancestor, a notable member of the McDonald kindred, whose name was John or Yon, and they claim descent from him, and so they call themselves after that particular person. So the surname changes, but they're still, anyway, and we're getting an overlapping there with branches and stuff like that. So anyway, with the Irish legal codes, it is a lot more spelled out, and it usually, a sept is usually I think more regularly an actual branch of the family. In fact, there are some scholars who argue, and I don't know how common this sentiment is amongst the scholarly community, that when speaking of Ireland, you should use the word sept and not the word clan. However, one more touch up on that last episode, that I don't think we should get wrapped around the axle by which English words we're referring to. That are we going to use clan, or are we going to use family, or are we going to use sept? Let's not get too. I know we like to put everything in their nice, tidy little categories with their little organizers in between everything and their little cubicles and the cubicle dividers and this word and this has this meaning and goes in this chunk and it's all just nice and tidy. It's not nice and tidy. And it doesn't, the English words don't directly translate to the Gaelic words. And the Gaelic has a host of different words that indicate relation of various degrees, and keep in mind a very poetic language. And I'm not saying English is not a poetic language, but in the Gaelic, you're lots of different ways to say that somebody is descendant of somebody else. All right, okay. So let's just not get too caught up there. But so in response to Clive here, yeah. So Wilsons, were there some Wilsons who were, no kidding, connected to the guns? Sure there was. That was quite a tangent I'd gone off of. Yes, there were Wilsons that were related or part or connected to the guns. So my question then that I wrote back to Clive Wilson was, how close can you trace your ancestry to gun territory, geographically speaking? Because think of it, Wilson, son of Will, how common had that to have been? That could have occurred anywhere in Scotland or England or anywhere in the anywhere. So I would say that how close can geographically you can get to that? If you can trace your ancestry to somewhere in Caithness, Sutherland, somewhere near Inverness even, I would say maybe you got a pretty good shot at actually connecting into the clan gun. Okay. And lastly, as far as my Facebook page comments goes, I have a question that Ginger Murphy Solomon wrote in. And she would have posted this on the page, but I think really the only way that the way that I've got this set up is that you can communicate and send me messages, but you can't post things on the Facebook page, which if I could change that and snap my fingers, I would. I don't really know how, and if there's a way to do that and I can change it to where it's a page instead of a group, or a group instead of a page, it's a page, we would need to make it a group. If you know how to do that, go to the Scottish Clans Facebook page and let me know. All right, so Ginger is doing some research, and she's trying to do some historical fiction and make it believable and historically accurate. And so this is the question that she's writing about. She says, I've written one book set in the 17th century and I'm working on to finish two others. I've done a bit of research online, but can't tell if my scenario for one of the books is accurate/believable. The clan chief dies without male heir. His tanisht, which we talked about previously in a couple episodes ago, also dies in the same skirmish. So, yeah, that poses a problem. To continue Ginger's question, would the chief's grandson, through the chief's daughter, then take over as chief? In parentheses, he's an adult. Would he be required to change his name? He was not raised among his mother's relations, but with his father's. Someone from the Scotland from the roadside group suggested I post my question on this page, but I couldn't post it publicly. All right, so there's my question to anybody who's listening. If you know the answer to that, please respond, and we will make sure that we use the power of the group here. Because Ginger, I don't know the answer to that right off the top of my head, and I've got other things that I've been researching, so I haven't really dived into that to the degree that maybe you're needing here. I think I'm going to use my platform then to help you, and that's where I hope I can be of some use to you. So there you go. Anybody who knows the answer to that, please contact the Scottish Clans Facebook page, give me the answer, and I will forward that on to Ginger. All right, so, and then I just have just really quick Podbean stuff here. I've got from Border Johnston, who has commented before, said, Clint, very informative on what the septs are. I'd always defined a sept as being adopted by a clan, which can kind of be true, so you're not necessarily wrong. Another is from... I don't think I did this last time, but maybe, I think I did actually, so I'm not going to worry about that. All right, that's all I got for today for listener feedback, and I'm trying to keep that brief and succinct, but we'll also keep up the dialogue, because I think it's great to take some of these things that people are saying and throw them out there for the good of the group that oftentimes, like you've seen today, are very good questions, very valid points. So Micah, Clive, Ginger, Border Johnston, thank you for reaching out, and I'll continue to try to keep up on this and respond in a timely manner. So if I don't respond in a timely manner actually on the Facebook page, you know, keep listening, because I might just bring it up on the next episode. All right, so here's what I want to talk about today. Grams. So I look out looking into the grams, and there's, you know, like I said earlier, more than one person requested something on the grams. Now, once again, what I don't hope to do with this podcast is just regurgitate things you can find in a Wikipedia article or things you can find on any number of Scottish Clan Facebook or websites. There's a host of them. Now, I will say, I did go to electricscotland.com, which I have been a fan of since college. And early college. So for me, we're talking the early 2000s. So the better part of 20 years ago, this gentleman that runs this website, and he's not the author of a lot of it. What he's done is he's compiled it. And the article on the grams is lengthy. He's got a lot, probably more information here. And I think this is true of Electric Scotland, generally speaking. There's more information. You can find generally longer clan profiles or clan histories. And sometimes, in a lot of cases, actually, he includes more than one account of the clan. So the one on the grams is pretty long. So once again, I am not trying to just regurgitate things. You could do a Google search on and find them really easy. I'm not going to do that. What I would like to do is share with you some things that are interesting, maybe some behind-the-scenes things, maybe some information that not everybody's just going to pop up at the top of a Google search. Okay, so let me just talk about start off with the origin of the grams here. There's the founding member of the grams. they trace the first person. Okay, like let's back up even farther. There are some legendary origins of the Grahams. Like they come from a guy named like a Pict or a native Caledonian who fought against the Romans. Okay, look, guys, why do we think that a guy who has a name resembling Graham, who lives many centuries before surnames came into use, why do we think that we're going to inherit his name? I have no idea I know some guy back in the 1800s, well, actually, in this case, it's farther back than that. Guys from the 1500s are starting, but it's so anachronistic. That's when you are presenting history, but you, well, in this case, this is just the perfect example of an anachronism. You're saying that the Graham kindred inherit their surname, but somehow that happened through several centuries of nobody using surnames. Doesn't make any sense at all. The surnames didn't become in general use till way later than anybody calling themselves a Pict lived. And okay, so when people stop calling themselves Picts? I don't know really, but probably no later than the 900s, okay? People are identifying as Picts. So we're just gonna kick that one to the curb. The earliest recorded person bearing the name Graham as a surname was William Le Graham, L-E space Graham. Now, people are like, oh, it says Le, which is the French for the, and was common amongst the Normans, so he must be a Norman. Well, maybe he was a Norman. However, when the Normans, we've gone over this before, the Normans come into Scotland not as conquerors. They were invited. And it wasn't just one king that did this, one Scottish king, but David I was pretty conspicuous because they charged up there with him and helped him get his throne back from his kin that sent him into hiding, well-treated in exile amongst the Norman leaders of England. And so he says, who wants to help me go get my throne back? A bunch of them throw in with him, and he was gracious to him because it worked. And so he starts giving them, anyway, a lot of them are invited in, and the French Norman culture becomes very stylish. And so people who have no connection to the Normans are all of a sudden using Norman titles, and you know, it was the cool thing to do, and we do it all the time now. And so, you know, like people in popular culture who talk a certain way, and then people who have no connection to that, you were brought up somebody somewhere completely different, but it's how the guys on the popular whatever, this or that, and so we talk. So no different. So they're going to style them. So probably a lot of them learned. A lot of the native Gaelic-speaking aristocrats learned to speak French, because that's what a lot of the cool guys coming in are speaking. They're building cool castles. They're very capable people, and so we're gonna bring in whatever in their culture. So just because it's William Le Graham does not automatically mean that he's of Norman descent. Okay, so it's William Le Graham is the first person. The legend, the story goes, he's got two sons, and so you have really two branches. So one of the branches, and I'm not gonna go over all the different places. But there's really three centers of gravity for the Grahams. You have the ones around that who become the Earls of Menteith, and then you have the ones, so famous Grahams, you've got the Duke of Montrose, who leads the Royalist forces during the 1640s in the War of the Three Kingdoms, where you have the, anyway, a lot of stuff going on there. A famous Graham there. You can read all about him. That's not my point to talk about him. But there was a couple, the Viscount Dundee, another another famous Graham. Very just a lot of capable people came out of this bloodline, this kindred. So the Montrose group, they're farther over in Angus, and over on that eastern shore of Scotland, over on that side of things. Some of them, that group of them, also had territory closer to Perth. But then you have the Menteith Grahams, and they, so the interesting talk about Graham is because, you know, in this podcast, I'm not just trying to make this the West Highland and Isles Scottish clan podcast. I'm not trying to do that. You know that I've made an effort to roam around Scotland talking about different kindreds, regardless of their geographic origin, no matter how popular the Highlanders are, especially after stuff like Outlander gains popularity. So, in doing an episode on the Grahams, we're really covering a spot of Scotland that we have not been into before. Yeah, we've done the Gordons and the Forbes feud, but that was farther north, closer to Aberdeen. And so this is a part that we really have not touched on much. So the Menteith Grahams, what got me thinking about that, they are east of Loch Lomond, and they kind of straddle the Highland-Lowland line. And they are listed in that 1587 government document that talks about here's the clans that are more loyal to their chiefs than they are to the government. And it lists a bunch of Highland clans, but also border surnames. I think we can use the term clan there too, since once again, we're not going to get wrapped around the axle about surnames versus clans versus kindreds versus families versus septs. So the border, you got border guys listed and you got Highland guys listed, which that always sent me into a tailspin wondering, like, how come the only people mentioned on this are Highlanders and borders? Were the nobody else in Scotland? And anyway, if you want, I've done earlier episodes where I've answered that question through research, and I list scholarly sources. So I think the title of that one was, Is Your Clan Really a Clan? Or something along those lines. And so we just kind of skip over this area where the Grahams are located. So, but the Grahams of Menteith are listed on that list. So there you have it. And then there's one more place where we find Grahams, and that is down on the border with England. In fact, the Grahams who migrate, so this is kind of swimming upstream. A lot of, if the Grahams were originally Normans, a lot of the Normans were welcomed into Scotland and first gained territory in the lowlands and then were rewarded, went on to pursue other things farther north, which many of them did with great success. Off the top of my head, we've got Sinclairs, we've got, if you want to count Fresca de Moravia, even though they call him a Frisian, he was in the same, I don't know, maybe let's not call him a Norman. I think there's too many other things going on there. But you got the Sinclairs, you got the Frasers, the Chisholms, maybe the Grants, the Cummins. So anyway, those are just what I've got off my top of my head. And they're all people who are coming in, like the Frasers would be a great example of this. They get established down in Lowland Scotland, and then they're pushing up, and then they have the Lovett branch up on the shores of Loch Ness, who become very, very famous up there through their different involvements. The Grahams go the opposite direction. So maybe they're Normans, maybe they're some other introduction. We'll get to that in a second. But we first see them come about if farther north, and then they get property down there on the border. And those Grahams actually, numbers-wise, according to Steel Bonnets by George MacDonald Fraser, they are actually a little bit more English than they are Scottish as far as numbers-wise. But I can't remember how the exact quote went, but they're Scottish when it's to their advantage and English when it pleases them. Anyway, something that they switch back and forth depending on expedience. But they lived in the debatable land and were in there with the Armstrongs as arguably the most unruly, crazy, raiding, fighting group of people on the borders. Now, when you say on the borders, you're already in a very warlike, turbulent environment and that they would stick out is really interesting. So yeah, they're right down there in the western borders. And like I said, they straddle that line with probably the center of gravity, numbers-wise, lying on the English side. But they are border reavers through and through, that branch of the family. All right, so those are the three different kind of centers of gravity. There's different branches like Kincardine and these other places that they have territory, but that's kind of their three main centers of gravity, that eastern coast, the Menteith area, and then down the border. All right, so here's what I want to share with you that is not just what you can find with a quick Google search. And I think, I believe I found this article on academia.edu. Now, I'm here to tell you, if you're not using that as a source, and you are one of, I got it that some of you are just tuning into this because you want to hear a story, or you just want to get into a little bit more, and you can do it while you're listening, but you can do other things with your hands, and you're not. But for those of you who are really wanting to dive in this in a scholarly way, if you're not using academia.edu, I really think that you are neglecting a good source. Let me tell you some of the people on there. I've seen Alex Wolf. He wrote that book I've mentioned in earlier episodes called, what was it? It was From Pictland to Alaba. And I shared some things I learned out of that book, some really interesting things there. Catherine Swift, who I cited last episode, who I got some of my information on the Irish septs, and she goes into a ton more detail than I went into. It's not a forum. It's not a bunch of people who may or may not be an expert in this. These are people sharing scholarly work. I've shared my master's thesis on there, which I do not claim to be in the same category as the names I've already mentioned, but I mean, not even close, but my point is there's some quality work done on there. And anyway, I think that's where I got this. So this, what I'm going to cite here is called Graham Origins, Arms and the Man by Lloyd D. Graham. So I'm going to try to post a link to this, but if you're going to use academia.edu, you've got to register with them, but it's free. You don't have to be associated with any institution of higher learning, with a university or anything like that. It's not like JSTOR, which I think you can have a limited membership there, but it's limited unless you want to pay more. I think, and if you're actually going through a university, it's wide open to you. So I don't think that this is the same way. You know what? There is another level of academia.edu. There is. I lied. There is another level of academia.edu that you can access if you pay a little money. And I think I did that for a couple months, but I just didn't find the stats useful enough to me. But look, I found a lot of cool stuff on there. So that's where I got this article. Now he's going to cite some DNA work, and that's what I really want to get to, is the DNA work that he goes into here, because I think it's fascinating. All right, and I'm just going to read some from his paper. So he gives a little background on what a Y chromosome is and why you get a Y chromosome test, or some people call it a Y DNA test. So let me just jump in right here. For the Grahams, the signature of the ancestral Scottish Grahams, the A group, is Y chromosomal haplogroup J1, which is defined by a marker, and he talks about all the little subgroups here. Here's the deal. This, and I'm going back into quoting now, this subclade of J1 is extremely rare on the world scene, but is common among the Grahams. Over time, the naming convention has changed as more precise subgroup information has emerged. So the Graham Y haplogroup. Let me go down. The other important. I'm gonna read a. There's a part in here that's a sub. Okay, I'm quoting from an article, but now the article is gonna quote here. Okay, and this comes from It's cited. Hey, just find the article and you can find out who they're quoting here. But let me just start reading. By far the largest single family group in our GRAM DNA project has been tested as J1. They match each other closely, and we believe that they all descend from the single ancestor who founded the ancient GRAM family in Scotland in the early 1100s, pause on the quote, which matches the time frame for William Le Graham. Okay, quote, their most recent common ancestor has been estimated to live 700 to 950 years ago. This is in accord with the history of the noble house of Graham in Scotland, as the first recorded member was William, oh, sorry, I've been saying it wrong the whole time, William de Graham. So William of Graham, not William the Graham. Okay, William de Graham, circa 1080 to 1127, a fluxus diagram of the Graham J1 subgroup suggests that the family split into two quite early in the piece, and this is family split into quite early in the piece, and this also agrees with the historical record, as there have been two main lines of Grahams in Scotland from about 1400 onward. Okay. So why do we care about the fact that they're a J1? Okay, most of the people whose paternal line, so just quick little information, Y DNA, Y chromosome, that's passed from father to son, father to son, father to son. It's a patriarchal line marker. And most people whose patriarchal line is indigenous to the British Isles has the genetic marker of R1B. And there's subgroups within that. But that's what most people who are native to the British Isles have. That's by far the most common genetic marker, and it indicates an Aboriginal population there that predates any historical records. And you can go, there's people who've written all about it. Stephen Oppenheimer, Brian Sykes, there's a bunch of that. You can get as deep into that as you want. But the reason that, so that's the R1B. So what about J1? Well, there's an article, there's a map included on this. Guys, J1 is indicative of a Middle Eastern background. And remember, go back to that quote. Where are we finding this coming from? The 10, 1100s time frame? So it's not some before the dawn of man, Paleolithic guys roaming around the tundra after the ice age. And no, this is not that. This is like late Viking, early Norman period here. And I got it. Like, I understand the Normans, Vikings, I got it. But 1000s, 1100s, that's when this is going back to. Because they can find when this would have deviated and developed its own little signature. And that's so they can trace it back. The hot spots for this genetic marker are on the southeastern portion of the Sinai Peninsula, the southwestern chunk of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the Ethiopia, you know, immediately opposite the Red Sea from Saudi Arabia. And there's a little hot spot, meaning a lot of people had this genetic marker, on the northwestern shore of the Caspian Sea. But this is a Middle Eastern thing. This is a genetic marker that's possessed by Arabs and Jews. Is that not fascinating? The group, the center of gravity, so from all the people with the Graham surname that were genetically tested, there's a core of them. Now, numerically, on their own, they're not more than half. They're smaller than half. But none of the other subgroups individually add up to more than this group, okay? So numerically, for any one single connected, related group of Grahams, this is the biggest group, which this is the group that they are saying descends from William de Graham. The other groups, I'll actually read this. The other important observation from the Graham Surname Project is that the largest Y haplogroup among Grahams in general is not J1, but R1B. Let me unpack that for you. So, and it doesn't say what exactly the numbers were in here. So let's say if you had 30% of the grams that were tested had the J1, so that's way less than half. But the rest of the 70%, once again, I'm just throwing these numbers out here. This is not what the study says. The rest of the 70% are broken down into 15 different groups. So not one of those 15 groups is larger than this group with the J1 marker. Okay. All right, let me continue. This says this group consists of at least 15 unrelated small families plus numerous unrelated individuals. And from this, it is evident that the R1B grams from the B group for this surname, i.e. disparate families native to the British Isles who adopted the Graham surname but who are not descended from William de Graham. Okay, now we have talked about this and talking about clans before. There are so many people within a clan who would have, you know, it's kind of the opposite of what I was saying before. You have people within the clan, septs of the clan, you could say, who have a different surname but are actually blood connected. They're called McKeon, but they're actually McDonald's, right? Blood wise, they are part of the group. This is the opposite of that. They share the surname, but genetically they're not connected. They're one of those other types that I mentioned earlier that find themselves in this land. Their boss is the Graham. They owe loyalty to the Graham. Maybe he's even treated him kindly, and there's not just, hey, he's my feudal lord, but this guy's running a tight ship. I wanna be a part of this. And so guess what? We're going to be Grahams. Yep. Dad, are we actually related to them? Nope. But we're Grahams. Okay, so that's what it's saying here. Disparate families native to the British Isles who adopted the Graham surname but who are not descended from William de Graham. Okay, I'm just going to scroll down through because I've highlighted different spots that I wanted to touch on. So what does this mean for William de Graham or whoever it was that founded the ancestral Graham line in Scotland? Put bluntly, it seems that he was either an Arab or a Jew. The Graham subclade J1L1253 is approximately equidistant from the prophet Muhammad and Aaron. Now, if you remember, Aaron from your Old Testament history is Moses' brother. He had played a pretty significant role in the Exodus and in their life after the Exodus of the Israelites. So this genetic marker that you find these grams from, they're not descended from Muhammad or his group or from Aaron and his group, so they're not Cohens. They're not from the tribe of Levi, but they do share an ancestor with both of those people, okay? Which I really didn't know that the Prophet Muhammad actually shared ancestry with, but makes sense. They're all in the Middle East and people move around a lot. All right, so however, the Graham's genetic next of kin, as revealed by Y haplotype analysis, clearly favors Arab roots over Jewish ones. So how do you like that? Just to scroll down a little bit further in that same paragraph, the simplest explanation for the observed data is that the Crouches, so this is an English surname that has similar DNA. The Crouches are also descended from an Arab, but one that migrated to England independently of William de Graham, a different individual with a slightly different Y haplotype, even though he was still a J1. Okay, where does this leave our, so I'm going to quote now. Okay, I'm just reading straight from the paper. Once again, I'll try to get the copy of this up on Facebook. Where does this leave our various origin myths? The beliefs of camps 1 and 2 that William de Graham was a Pict or the son of a native Scotsman are clearly untenable. Pause on the quote. That's what I was saying earlier. Quote, a man drawn from the indigenous population of Scotland or of the British Isles in general would necessarily have belonged to Y haplogroup R1B. The possible presence of Danish women in the bloodline, group 2B, is of no consequence since the Y chromosome is passed directly from father to son. There is never any female contribution. R1B is certainly the largest haplogroup among the Grahams, but as mentioned above, its members come from at least 15 different small families which are not related, augmented by any other equally unrelated individuals. It is clear that these R1B Grahams are descended from disparate families native to the British Isles who adopted the Graham surname rather than from the founder of the ancestral Graham line in Scotland. Those indigenous families no doubt include some of the Pictish and Scottish descent, but that is irrelevant to the identity of William de Graham and the origin of the ancestral line of Grahams in Scotland. The origin myths of Camp 3, which posit Norman or Flemish paternal origins for William de Graham, are also problematic. At first glance, it seems that one might account for William's exotic haplogroup by ascribing him to a J1-containing pocket, 2 to 10%, centered on the northwestern German coast, which extends into southern Denmark and the northeastern Netherlands. Unfortunately, this pocket corresponds to a subclade of J1 that does not contain the Graham haplotype. The J1-P58 subclade, which does contain it, presents no such pocket in Germany or its neighbors, or for that matter, anywhere else in Northern Europe. So pause real quick, just kind of catch you up. The type, so there is a small pocket of this J1 DNA in Europe, right up in where Germany, Denmark, and Frisia, that kind of area out there. There are some people up there with that J1 marker, but they're not in the same side of the house. They're different from that. So that's kind of an interesting point. Whoever the Grahams are descended from, this William de Graham, wherever this line comes out of, it's not people, this island of J1 in that geographic location in Europe, that actually some of this Norman Northwest continental European movement with the Normans, it's not that. To continue quoting, another blow to the Camp 3 theories is that Grahams do not show de Tankervilles, Chamberlains, de Hestons, Mallets, or other surnames distinctive of Normandy or Flanders as Y chromosome genetic relatives with a surgical time depth, a time frame within which plenty of Arab testers in the Middle East surface as relatives. So there's a lot of these theories that the Grahams were coming, they're a branch of the Tankervilles, Chamberlains, de Hestons, Mallets. Sometimes they use heraldry and looking at they're using really similar heraldry, so maybe these two families are connected and maybe this and that. The DNA evidence doesn't support that. In fact, during that time period, they can find closer relatives in the Middle East. So back to quoting. For those British/European surnames that are part of a Y haplogroup study, Chamberlain, Mallet, and their variants, not a single tester has returned a J1 haplogroup, a fact which precludes those families sharing a common paternal ancestor with the founder of the ancestral Graham line in Scotland. I'm skipping some stuff here because I don't want to read the whole thing, but we have already seen that Arnulf de Heston died in 1097 at the Siege of Antioch. Robert Curthose, a son of William the Conqueror and brother to William II and Henry I of England, was, as Duke of Normandy, an important crusade commander. There was, therefore, direct contact between the Arabs of Outremer, and the aristocracy of Northern Europe, contact that provided a conduit between the Levant, where subclade J1P58 is 5 to 10% of the population, rising to just less than 20% in adjacent Syria, and Britain, from which J1P58 would at that stage have essentially been absent. Perhaps in this very different sense, the Graham trajectory does have Norman or Flemish beginnings, unquote. So maybe they're saying the Normans, who were very active in the Crusades, brought back somebody. There's different ways that could have happened. Some of the speculation that this Lloyd Graham goes on to share with us, quote, William's story is lost to us. Was he the child of a female pilgrim by a Levantine Arab, taken to England with his mother by a returning Norman or Flemish knight? Was he the son of Muslim parents killed during the reconquest of Jerusalem, spared on account of his youth and taken to Britain by homeward-bound crusaders as a slave? Was William an orphan from a family of Christian Arabs who became useful to the crusaders as a translator and was rewarded for his services with a new life in the West? Was his father a Muslim who somehow became enmeshed with the Crusader cause and converted to Christianity, seeking asylum for himself and his family among the Europeans? Did the Arab ancestor of the English Crouch family, who may well have been a contemporary of William's, come to Britain in the same way as the first Graham? Or is the Crusade a red herring? Was William's father already in Britain long before the Normans arrived in 1066, the grandson of an Arab trader or crewman whose ship had foundered in the English Channel? Several generations of intermarriage between William's forefathers and local women would have tempered any Arab traits to the point where his exotic heritage was no longer apparent. Could William's recent ancestors have been in Europe for centuries? Theoretically, his forefathers could have lived in southern Italy or Sicily, a region which, thanks to millennia of Arab influence, harbors large zones where the representation of J1P58 in the population is 2 to 10%. This territory was progressively conquered by the Normans between 999 and 1198. From 1066, the ongoing Norman conquest in the Mediterranean were contemporaneous with Norman control of England, and until the end of the following century, links between the two countries became increasingly close. In Norman Sicily, Arab counselors and secretaries took their place in the central administration, and perhaps some traveled with envoys to Norman England. Alternatively, William's forefathers could theoretically have lived in Al-Andalus, as Spain was slowly reclaimed over some 720 years, for Christendom from the Moors. The Arab and Berber Muslims would conquer most of the Iberian Peninsula from the Umayyad Caliphate by 720 CE. Some of that population were traded in Europe as slaves. The enslavement and sale of Muslim captives was still fairly common in southern France up to the 13th century. However, the lack of southern European branches in figure 2.9 is prima facie evidence in favor of a direct or at least a rapid transfer of William or a proximal paternal ancestor of his from the Middle East to Britain. So what they're saying there is, yeah, a lot of Arabs lived in Spain, but there's no genetic testing that they have found yet where any J1s in that southern France, southern Spain area correspond to the Grahams. So anyway, I just wanted to read you some of those theories that Lloyd Graham comes up with in this article. Anyway, it's well cited. The logic isn't incredibly off. I'm not a geneticist, so I can't poke holes in his research just from reading it. I think it's fascinating. And so here's what I really wanted to present to you today. What could I present to you in this episode that you can't just find just with a random Google search? You probably didn't know that the Grahams, at least the core group of Grahams who probably descend from the founder, William de Graham, you probably didn't know they have a Y-DNA marker of J1, indicative of an Arab ancestor. It's crazy. One way or the other, the Grahams provided some leadership to different groups within Scotland at some really crucial times in Scottish history. The Grahams are an interesting group of people. I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope I've left you with a mystery to solve. If you're a Graham and this has really just caught a hold of you, then maybe some of you are out there listening to this and you're thinking, I always liked that Arab music. I never knew why. And now I get it. Anyway, I hope this is enjoyable for you. Provides a little bit of a mystery. Good luck if you want to pursue this and track it down. I will probably break off my research of this right here and just leave it to you to take the rest of it. If any of you do find anything that you think would be any kind of an answer to any of these questions, please contact me through the channels that I've described before, which are facebook.com/clansofscotland. That's the Scottish Clans Facebook page. You can send me a message and I'll do what I did for Ginger there. If you're trying to talk to the whole group and I haven't figured out how to change this from a page to a group, then I will relay that in the way I did today. Also, you can reach out on Podbean via the app or podbean.com and Apple Podcasts, which we didn't have anything new on there, so I didn't really go to there today. But if you have anything that you want to reach out and contribute, questions you want to ask, feedback you want to give me, go to Apple Podcasts, leave me a review, like give me some stars there, and then give me a comment there. I'd love to hear from you. Or go to Podbean or go to Facebook. One way or the other, I value the feedback. I enjoy the dialogue that I've had with a lot of you, and I hope you keep listening. Join me next time. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do, but because I really don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. Oh, actually, I've got a really important message for you. I hope you haven't just turned this off yet. Really important. Hey, look, and I'll post this on the Facebook page too. I've got a little adventure that I was voluntold to do for the Army, and that's coming up really soon, and I'll be out of the loop for a month. So I may be able to squeak in one more episode, but if I'm going at the rate that I have been, that's probably an unlikely scenario. So will you please don't unsubscribe and just leave me? Don't do it, because when I get back, I'm probably gonna have a ton of thoughts, and I'm just gonna unload and do some episodes when I get back, and hopefully it'll be stuff that you're just hungering for. So be patient with me. Don't leave. Don't go anywhere. Enjoy all the other podcasts that you love, and come back to me when I get back in a little while. Hope you do well. I look forward to getting back into this again. And until then, may the good Lord be with you.